Yes, we are currently engaging in another late night chat with yours truly, except this time things are a bit more serious. Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne, The In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Today's book is, of course, Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell, one of my favorite intellectuals, humans, however you want to put it, of all time, and it is particularly exciting for me to have read this new book by him the week it came out, because it's the first book of his that has come out when I was old enough to order it myself, and previously with books such as David and Goliath, for example, I had to beg my mother to take me to the bookstore to buy them. Thanks, Mom, by the way, for buying your weird 14-year-old kid Gladwell books, but regardless, this read has been on my radar for 2 years, since 2017, and I'm so thankful to have gotten to read it pretty much immediately after its release. The story of how I ended up timing the readings of the book and the audiobook actually turned out to be quite unusual for me because, like any sane person, I generally read one or the other version of them first, followed by the second version. What happened with Talking to Strangers, though, was that I woke up at 6 in the morning, MST, on the 10th of September, and immediately started listening to the audiobook, which was by that time available to me, and listened to the first chapter in audio form. Keep in mind, though, that I had already listened to Chapter 3, The Queen of Cuba, multiple times in the audiobook format because it was released a few weeks ago as a bonus on Revisionist History, so I knew what to expect in terms of his new audiobook format and features, which I will explain later. Then skip ahead on that same day, Tuesday, September 10th to 2 p.m. when the physical book was delivered, and that was when I picked it up and really took off with reading the whole thing. In terms of what I would recommend reading, I'm always an advocate for picking up the original physical book first, especially for something this dense, because it's proven helpful, at least for me, to be able to go back and reread things that I couldn't catch the first time. I also found the visual layout of the book to be very impressive, very aesthetically pleasing, with the number of charts and graphs that he pulls from. There's a word completion task at one point, and as well there are extensive footnotes and other references that pulled in the amazing notes section at the back, which I love, all of which are obviously foregone when choosing the audiobook option first. I would also read the audiobook, however, because the audiobook is in the realm of some of the Audible originals that we've reviewed, like David Spade's audiobook, for example, where Gladwell has reenactments of court cases and real tapes of speeches, audio from documentaries, and the list of primary source material and interviews, for that matter, that he was really able to incorporate into the audiobook is quite impressive. I love hearing all of his interviewees' voices in real life, especially the people that end up telling crazy spy stories or double agent stories or recounting history. Like, for example, in Chapter 3, he interviews some of this double agent's colleagues from the CIA, and in Chapter 2, about meeting Hitler, Neville Chamberlain's meetings with Hitler, he pulls from speeches that Neville Chamberlain did about his visits to Germany and his time meeting with Hitler, and also later in the audiobook we hear from various autobiographical documentaries and audiobooks narrated by Amanda Knox, and we also hear from Harry Markopoulos of the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. The list goes on. To be more concrete, in my opinion, Talking to Strangers is a book that I know I will personally reach for and come back to time and time again. So for me, if it was the metaphorical gun to temple situation and I had to choose between the physical book or the audiobook versions, I would choose the physical book. However, the audiobook is absolutely worth a listen. I found it highly enjoyable as well, as I said, and will likely be listening to parts of it obsessively, trying to work out certain details until Revisionist History Season 5 is released. In order to continue, we are going to have to backtrack a lot so that I can explain once and for all why I'm so taken by Malcolm Gladwell. The first time that I encountered Malcolm Gladwell's name in a meaningful, memorable way was at a dinner party in 2014. His book David and Goliath, which was at that time still relatively new, was brought up, and I remember as my mother and her friend were passing these spark notes back and forth to each other, thinking about how much I identified with the way Gladwell's point seemed to develop over the course of his novel, book, I mean. 2014 was also the year that I didn't finish a single book in English class because the bottom line was I didn't read. As a side note, I legitimately had trouble finishing two books a year until 2016 when I told myself that it was ridiculous that someone who loved literature and books so much didn't read. So I went from reading two books a year to reading 52 books a year. If you think you can't do it, you can, because I did, and it was a very, very interesting social experiment for me to do. But back to the story at hand here, it was at some point between my reading lull and my reading tsunami, or in other words, between 2014 and 2016, that I happened to get my hands on Blink, David and Goliath, and What the Dog Saw books, which I read in what was, in the pre-tsunami days, rapid succession. It was at this point that I realized that I had in fact read quite a bit of Gladwell's work before, but in the form of these articled weekly reading challenges that my 7th grade English teacher gave us. Challenges, by the way, that I devoured because I had always loved to read. In 7th grade, I was a big reader. Most notably, I remember reading Gladwell's New Yorker article, The Ketchup Conundrum, linked in the description, an article that has stuck with me for whatever reason since. At the same time, in around 2016, I was attending an arts boarding school for the summer and discovered revisionist history out of the blue, and I can tell you the exact day that I first listened to an episode of revisionist history, the exact day that my addiction happened because of the advent of technology, and that was July 7th, 2016, the day that the fourth episode entitled Carlos Doesn't Remember came out, and I can very easily recall just this amazing spark of engagement that I had when listening to that episode for the first time. And it wasn't that I agreed with Gladwell 100% on all of his arguments, especially in that episode Carlos Doesn't Remember about colleges, I still don't, but I found the way in which he discovered and evaluated these little bits of information to be really valuable and compelling, and his pursuit of intellectualism to be really inspiring. It made me less embarrassed to be writing papers arguing that Brussels, Belgium was central to Marlowe's conception of self and truth and Heart of Darkness, or arguing that Offred from The Handmaid's Tale was a sociopath. In other words, Gladwell's connections of topics from ketchup to orchestras to elements of social psychology helped me understand and accept my own quirky ideas about connecting seemingly disparate topics in a single piece. He was the first person who seemed to say openly and repeatedly to me that it was okay to be an intellectual, to obsess over things that normal people don't obsess over, and to write, for example, for a living. There's much, much more that I could get into in regards especially to the timing of a lot of Gladwell's work in my life and why all of that had had particular influence over me, but in the name of time, and I also think in the general interest of our audience here, I will skip forward in time a little bit and talk about where I first heard about talking to strangers. I don't know if y'all have seen the description, but it's teeming with links and things because of how much I've just researched talking to strangers and Gladwell himself since July 2017, when I watched a guest appearance of Gladwell on a show called The Breakfast Club on YouTube that's linked down on the description. But about halfway through that interview, he tells essentially the origin story of the book, the genesis of this book, and talking to strangers, the idea was really interesting to me, so as I mentioned in the intro, this book for me has been a long time coming. I've mulled over how I should approach today's analysis probably thousands of times in the last week, because there's so much to uncover in regards to the book, and it's hard to figure out how to avoid spoilers but still create interest around its content, but I'm going to try all of that anyway, and I hope that I can begin to do this book justice, because at the end of the day, it's really very good and worth a read or two or three. What's interesting to me is that Gladwell's definition of strangers is taken for granted in the book, which means that he doesn't explicitly state, at least not to my memory, for example, maybe in the beginning of the book, his idea of what a stranger is, a definition, or the conception of the term stranger that he's working with, but he rather gives clues throughout the book about the different qualities present, either in humans generally or in specific groups of people, that create situations where dealing with strangers proves particularly difficult and and are often misinterpretive. In fact, the only mention of his working definition that I could find was actually in an interview on the Economist Asks podcast published a few weeks ago. He says, with an addition at the end from Anne McElvoy, the host, "A stranger is someone who we know in only one dimension, the one that presents itself to us." He explains that we know and understand our loved ones from many dimensions. So, for example, I know my best friend in her capacity as a tennis player, as a woman, as a friend, as a student, and so on. But strangers are difficult essentially because we don't have as much information on them, and we have to make situational judgments on them based on an inadequate amount of knowledge. If you're unfamiliar with Gladwell's work, by the way, what he often does is take a social phenomenon like the stranger problem and finds ways of explaining them and also solving them with help from theories from social psychology. There are many different theories, of course, that he draws from in Talking to Strangers. It's a long and very comprehensive book on the subject of strangers. If you have the book, I would recommend walking back the cat from his goldmine of sources, as I did, and also reading, for example, The Person in the Situation by Rawson Nisbett, as there are many experiments and such that he draws on from there, such as the Milgram experiments, super famous in social psychology and behavioral science. I loved that The Person in the Situation is also very highly influential to Gladwell, as he supposedly read it in one sitting and illegally copied it in the library to bring home, which is a story from his new preface of the book. That's all linked in the description. And even though it has taken me as long to read as it took Infinite Jest, I would in the end recommend it. The main connecting theory that Gladwell draws on for the majority of the book comes from Tim Levine, a social psychologist who introduced a concept called default to truth, which holds that humans evolutionarily evolve to believe that in a certain situation, a person is truthful, is telling the truth, unless the doubt of that person slash situation is so overwhelming that what we had previously considered to be the truth is rendered impossible. The golden example that Gladwell uses for this is a statement by one of Larry Nassar's victims by the name of Gonzar, who said, quote, "I believed in you always until I couldn't anymore," unquote. Links to articles of everything I'm mentioning, by the way, are of course in the description, including an article about Larry Nassar and this statement. Gladwell also at one point makes a very interesting argument that belief is not the absence of doubt, or in other words, that belief is not the opposite of doubt, but that doubt and belief work hand in hand, and it is due to default to truth that we're able to still believe even when a measure of doubt is present. That was the case in the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme, for instance. Further, the thing about default to truth is that, as I mentioned, it's an evolutionary trait because we need to default to truth to have a functioning society. Gladwell gives the example at one point of when a cashier tells you the total of your bill, you generally believe them because it would be a huge hassle and a huge time commitment to go out of your way to prove yourself that the bill was such and such amount. In other words, default to truth is a necessary trait, and the cost of a healthy functioning society based on things like default to truth is that, for example, once every few decades, a Bernie Madoff comes around. And then comes the part that was most difficult for me to digest, just because I found the idea so shocking and compelling at the same time, which was the concept of matched versus mismatched behavior in individuals. Matched behavior, to give a quick summary, is when someone who is, for example, anxious simultaneously has physical symptoms or indicators of being anxious, so sweating profusely, turning red, fidgeting, what have you. Someone who is mismatched, however, is, as Gladwell describes from experience that he went over in his book, statistically very hard to identify. So everyone from college students to police interrogators have trouble spotting a mismatched person, sometimes scoring with as low as a 14% accuracy when trying to identify, for example, liars when faced with a guilty-seeming innocent person. Hitler and Amanda Knox were both mismatched. Hitler as a sane, honest person when he was not, and Amanda Knox as a person capable of murdering her roommate when she was not. I know that this episode could never have begun to explain the mastery of talking to strangers, and like the Kindle episode a few weeks ago, this is another topic that I see myself revisiting on the show. For instance, I would love to find people to interview and talk to about the book, perhaps even some strangers, but thank you so much for listening anyway, and I do hope that you enjoyed the episode. My last rambly thing for tonight is that I do have a Patreon account. It is at patreon.com/relevanceofliterature. If you want to support the show, you now can, and you can go on Patreon and learn about what we are trying to do, making the show advertisement free for the next year and whatnot. Thank you. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there is an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net, and remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!